You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
I am so fortunate today for our guest is Scott Halford. He is an inductee into the National Speakers Hall of Fame, which is not easy to do, and there aren't many of you in there, an author, an Emmy Award-winning documentary writer and producer, and advisor to some of the most powerful companies in the world and their leader. His newest book, Activate Your Brain, which I just read, it's absolutely phenomenal, is a Wall Street Journal bestseller and is making a huge splash in people's lives. And I'm guessing that's because we're all interested in getting the best and most out of our brains, this weird thing that's in between our ears that we don't quite understand. Scott, you're an expert in emotional intelligence, which we're going to touch on a little bit, critical thinking and success. Scott also studies neuroscience and its application to our lifelong effectiveness. And he tells us how to maximize our brain for more stamina, fulfillment, and success overall. So, Scott, welcome. And I'm so disappointed to be interviewing such an underachiever. It's horrible.
I'm excited to be here. It's great.
Proud to say that I know Scott personally. So this is very exciting for me because I don't often get to dig into his expertise like I do now. So this is going to be a fun time. So, Scott, I just read Activate Your Brain, which, like I said, I got so much out of it. I took copious notes, but I just want to back up for a second and ask you why you even decided to put pen to paper and take all this knowledge and put it into a book that I would say is easy for, you know, someone like me who doesn't have a neuroscience background to actually understand not only why it's important, but how it applies to me. So where did that all come from?
Yeah, well, it pretty much started quite a long time ago when I was doing a lot of work and still do a lot of work in emotional intelligence with physicians and scientists and analytical people who really responded to the kind of the softer skills around EI. You know, emotional intelligence has things like assertiveness and flexibility and empathy. And when they could see it actually happen in the brain, they bought into it and did something with it. And so my basic ideology was to, you know, teach emotional intelligence with a neuroscientific bent. And then I just decided to jump into it. The book was it came out of all of that work. And the more, do you have that all in a book? And I'm like, well, it's in like several books, but I didn't invest
it. Funny you ask.
But I could put it in one book. And that's basically what I've done. And I'm not out there doing original research other than the fact that I do work with clients on a regular basis. And I use some of those, some of the anecdotal evidence that I see there in the book. But it really is for the most part a place for people to find out how to use useful things about their brain.
So this is a little bit of a tangent question, but you were talking about emotional intelligence and things like empathy and assertiveness and those things that come with it. I mean, I think it's maybe more accepted now, but when you started this, do you find that, I think maybe those of us who are hardwired for results, hard skills, had a hard time grasping emotional intelligence and how that relates to us?
100%. It was kind of like if you were, you know, if I was talking with a physician who was all about results, and was all about, you know, people are not paying me for my bedside manner. They're paying me for the result on the table or the diagnosis. When they actually saw the difference in the research about how people not only responded to them, but how they healed quicker. And that you could actually, the evidence was huge, and that things like optimism, that it's a better medical indicator of a second heart attack than medical indicators themselves. And so when you begin to amass that kind of research and then slowly but surely look inside the brain and prove that there are things that happen that cascade to other aspects of your life that help in stress, in aging of the brain, in disease management, it becomes a real thing.
Wow. So the whole EI is so fascinating, but that's a part of it. So I actually want to start at the start of your book That was very eloquent, wasn't it? So, but the reason why is, so your first story is about a quote unquote typical day, right? Like you go to bed stressed out about a deadline, you wake up about this presentation, I think it is, and you're stressed out and you check your emails and that stresses you out because your boss asked you for something. Then you snap at your kids, right? And then you go to work and like the day just kind of spirals from there. And I have to tell you that I was laughing at myself because as I was reading it, I was getting stressed out. And like it made me stressed out. And I thought, oh my God, I'm starting this book stressed out. but talk a little bit about why. I mean, that is the typical day, isn't it? Right, where like one thing triggers us onto the next, and it kind of spirals from there. So why start the book, you know, with a story that stressed me out? And you know, what
yeah,
were
well,
to get
I do
out
put
of?
A warning. You have to remember, I do put a warning there. Warning: this is going to stress you out. And I do it because I want people to all come to one place. I think we've all experienced that day. And it just snowballs out of control,
yeah.
And it gets crazy. And a lot of the executives that I work with live in that on a day-to-day basis. And so it's not an unusual space for them to be. And what I wanted people to do is recognize themselves and go, oh, my gosh.
That was totally that is, it.
Yeah, that's me. And by the time I get to the end of it, I talk about the fact that kind of setup, that kind of day is by and large a choice. Mm. And you have a choice about that. You don't have a choice about the things that come at you.
Right.
But you do have not only a psychological, but a biological choice about how you respond to that. And then what are the subsequent responses down the road? Because it all affects it. It's a pile on, if you will.
So
we get worse as the day moves on.
Yes, we do. Yes. No, not me. No, never. Let's talk a little bit about that biological choice, though, because you say, if I wrote this down right, making a choice is the signal to our brain that we are ready to begin a journey. And the reason I want to dig into choice and that the concept of it being more biological or the level of that than just like, oh, look, it's a choice. You know, it's kind of how we talk about it out in the world. Is because, you know, a lot of people that listen and watch this conversation are entrepreneurs, right? And that is the roller coaster ride of every day feels like an up and down, but it feels a little bit out of your control because today I got the big win with a client. Tomorrow I you know, realized I had a bill I didn't know I had to pay. The next day, you know, so it's up and down. And same with entrepreneurs, I think, too. So how does choice and that day to day and that biological understanding, how does that impact your ability to deal with that?
It's a very big question. It has its roots in very many biological aspects of the brain, and I'm not going to go crazy on them. But
yeah.
What I will say is that there's a part in your brain, the last thing that forms in our brain is right behind our eye sockets right here. Mm-hmm. And they're called the medial orbital frontal cortex. And they're literally the parts that play ping pong between stop and go, all day long, stop and go. They help us make ethical decisions. They help us get out of the bed in the morning and decide that we're going to go exercise as opposed to stay in bed. They're the things that help us not spend money on things we're not supposed to. They're also they're responsible for laziness, responsible for motivation.
So it's both sides.
They're both sides. So
yeah.
The right side is the no button. The left side is the go button, if you will. So we have no go, no go, no go. And they both have upsides to them. So the go button, of course, is the motivation. Go, get it done. It's also the button that says, let's get addicted to things.
Mm.
Go, keep on going, keep on going. Because it's got the neurotransmitter dopamine involved. And dopamine is the neurotransmitter that causes you to feel pleasure and makes you want to do something again and again and again. So you can become addicted to positive things,
right?
But also negative things.
Right.
The no side says, stay in bed. No, sleep is better. It also says, do not spend that money on that sweater. You don't need another sweater, right? Kind of thing. So it's the dance between those two that it goes on all day long. When we don't reconcile that dance, and it's a constant, oh, should I, shouldn't I, should I, shouldn't I, we literally increase our stressor response to the environment. And when we do that, we literally at the same time become worse at making the decision we should be making anyway. Once we make it, we release that stressor response, and we make it. And then if we make the decision, if we make the choice, then we can respond to the choice. But until we do, we're not responding to anything. We're just simply locked in our head between no, go, no, go, no, go, no, go.
I think we've all, it sounds horrible, and I think we've all been there.
Yeah.
So how do you get out of that? If you're ping-ponging, which I think, you know, whether it's getting out of bed or, you know, pressing the send button on that critical email, it sounds like that translates into really everything we do, big and small. Mm-hmm. How do you get your brain, or how do you practice getting to a decision, a better decision faster, I guess?
Well, again, it's a complex question with a complex answer. It's a simple question with a complex answer. And the complex answer is that it depends on, you know, if you're buying a house or a car, there are different things that come to play than if it is just simply whether to send an email or buy the sweater or decide whether you're going to go on this vacation or that vacation. There are lots of things that your brain triages around in terms of what's expensive, what's not. We have all of our psychological baggage that comes if we're making a decision to spend a lot of money, for instance, on a house or a car or, you know, furniture, whatever it is, and we just don't know whether we can. The thing that I say to people is you literally want to go through a triage process. Your gut knows one thing, and your gut is telling you, I want it. But it's not necessarily telling you that you should have it.
Right.
It's just that you want it.
And but so what you have to those, don't we?
Yeah. And so what we want to do is you know, it was Henri Poincaré, is I think how you say his name, a French psychologist who said, you know, 100 years ago, he basically said, the intuition finds the truth, the intellect confirms it.
Oh.
And
wow.
And so you want to understand that your brain actually, the intuitive is a spot in your brain. We can actually see different neural networks light up. And it's telling you something that you have enough information to make a decision, but then you want to confirm it with the analytical part. And that is sit down and now triage it. Go through your Ben Franklin or whatever it is. What if I do have it? What if I don't have it? You know, what's the upside? What's the downside? How's it going to affect my life going forward in terms of cost? Will I hurt myself in terms of cost? Is the cost analysis, you know, it's the kind of a profit and loss statement on the decision. And the more that you do it, the quicker you get at it. And I also don't think, you know, I think we got accidentally in trouble with the concept of blink. And Malcolm Gladwell's book is wonderful, and it absolutely is correct for some things.
Yeah.
And that we are really better at making quick decisions about really big, you know, if I'm going to buy the house, you actually know that before you know that. You know it in your gut before you know it in your head. But then the wrestling match goes on, and it's really difficult unless you can have some kind of system that allows you to break down that decision. But for the most part, you know, you're just going to have to get to the place, if you're an indecisive person, to making a decision, living with it, and then correcting your way.
Being okay with that.
Yeah, you just make a decision.
So I have two questions that I want to, well, one thing I want to see if I'm interpreting correctly, and I want to ping pong off what you just said too, to innovation as well, because I think innovation, the space that I play in, is a lot about making a decision and then correcting versus analysis paralysis. But before I get into that, if I hear you right, it sounds like the way to really move forward and to activate your brain in a way that works for you in these situations and dealing with the ping pong is honor the decision and then justify it versus trying to justify to get to a decision. Because that's where it sounds like, right? People get to that back and forth, they can't, versus like, I don't know if I want that sweater. I don't know. Let me think about it versus I want that sweater. Now let me do it my own little structured cost analysis on if I should really get it. Does that even make sense?
Well, and the other part of it is that, you know, we kind of have a running tally of our lives in our head at all times. And that tally is, and some people are not great at the tally. Some people have a tally that says, I can afford anything I want. And other people say, have a tally that actually budgets in their head, if you will, and they know where they stand. And that those are kind of the two extremes. And most of us are somewhere in between. And that's where we get lost in indecision is like, I don't know if I can. And it's not all about money, by the way. It is also about, you know, whether it's going to fit and not the clothes, but what if it's going to fit in my life, or is this a good decision? Is it a bad decision? I think for the most part, people who are decisive make all of their decisions relatively a good decision, And when it's not, they move to a decision that is good.
They
so
move correctly. They correct
eventually
quickly.
You get to a good decision. I think people are really hell-bent on making the right decision the first time.
Right.
And certainly it's costly sometimes if you don't. That's life.
I
just think life is costly sometimes, and we learn from – I've made some really good bad decisions that have been costly. But, you know, I'm alive and I'm successful, right?
And you have fabulous glasses. It's all good.
Yeah,
well, right. Well, I think that's a great example, right? So you've made these good, bad decisions, but you're wildly successful in what, in particular, and an expert in your field. So it's not like those decisions ruin you. And in fact, I think if we looked at Elon Musk or Steve Jobs or any of these people that are these kind of famous innovators out there, they've made a lot of bad decisions, good bad decisions, as you said, over time. So how does this, so as you know, I play in innovation, and you know, when you're dealing with entrepreneurs or intrapreneurs, a lot of it is, how do you think differently about things? How do you take what you see in front of you, because you can't change, you know, this, but you can change your perspective on it so that you can come out with a different outcome, a more innovative result, a way to kind of rise above all that noise that's out there. So I'm curious from your perspective, and you know, I was kind of, I had a question here about the three brains, and I don't know if that's kind of, now's the time to loop that back in, but how do, when you're innovating, when you're in that space of being creative, whichever kind of word you want to use, how does that work from a brain perspective? That was so scientific the way I asked it.
It's another really good question. You have really good complex questions, but
I do my best.
In simplistic terms, we know that innovation and evaluation are two separate activities in the brain, and they are not compatible at the same time. And so when we come up with ideas and then try to evaluate them at the same time, we're literally turning on and off between the two. So analysis actually stops creativity. But we need to get to analysis. We need to get to the place of evaluating our creativity. And whether we can use it, and what do we do with it from here? We need to get to that place. You can't just be creative any more than you can just be analytical.
Right.
And what happens with most people is they try to innovate and evaluate at the same time. And what I try to teach people in critical thinking is the idea that you really want to leave a time, an hour or two, or however long you're going to be in a meeting with people, to innovate. To just think. And it's not brainstorming. It's very different than brainstorming. It's literally, and you could call it brainstorming, but it's not just coming out with the first thing that comes into your head.
Right.
It's literally kind of taking the puzzle and re-putting it together in different ways, being willing to play, being willing to throw out convention, and understand that some puzzle pieces might fit together upside down and reverse, and you might have to push a little hard. Yeah. It's okay. It's all okay. That it doesn't mean that you
but not analyzing your thoughts and if they're good or bad.
Well, exactly. You don't want to go, this doesn't fit into the rectangle puzzle piece that I'm trying to, you know, who says it has to be rectangular at the end?
Right.
And so you do it, and then once you do it, you stand back, and the moment that you stand back, it's like an artist putting on the paint, and that's the innovation, the creation.
Right.
The moment the artist stands back and says, how does that look? They're now evaluating. Process. And so you want to innovate. So if an artist all day long spent putting on a brush, standing back, another brush stroke, stand back, brush stroke, it'd never get anywhere, and it would be probably a pretty weird
thing. You'd probably never pick up a paintbrush again. It would be so painful.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's kind of, though, I just want to break that down for a second, because that's I've never thought of it that way. Although, you know, I do a lot of culture of innovation work, where I, you know, there's a no judgment kind of zone, and then there's the kind of voting analysis filter it down zone. But I've never really understood to that level that innovation and evaluation can't actually live together in the same space to be done well, anyway.
To be done at all.
Yeah.
It literally are two incompatible brain spaces. You know, so if you truly look at innovation, if you look at like some of the nominal group theory, where we talk about literally brainstorming on your own as an individual and then bringing it to the group to evaluate, that's probably the most successful thing that we can do, because the moment that we get into a group, we go through self-editing and group editing, and we regulate and we're like, oh, that's not a good idea. That person had an idea kind of like mine. I'm not going to bring mine up. Well, you know, if you look in the brain and you look at you know, shoe, and then you look at shoes, those are two slightly different pathways. A plural is slightly different. You start talking about a pair of shoes as opposed to one shoe. It's a different discussion. So the moment that you have an evaluative discussion that says, well, shoe is the same as shoes. Well, no, it's not. Well, yes, it is. Well, no, it's not. You're out of creation. And now you're into trying to narrow the pathway as opposed to having lots of different random thoughts, which is where innovation and creativity and new thoughts happen.
Oh, that is fascinating. I feel like I have a whole new foundation for why I want people not to judge out of the gate. But, you know, just really quickly on the brainstorm thing, there was a great article, I don't know if you saw it, in the Harvard Business Review about how we're over-collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
And really what they're saying is not that we shouldn't be relationship-driven, but that we spend too much time in groups with, and I think all those things tend to happen, where we edit, we look to the most senior person in the room and their ideas get pushed forward because they're the most senior person. Or, you know, our ideas end up getting funneled, I think, down a road that we wouldn't have gone down because somebody else pushed everything down that path.
Right.
And that brainstorming really is about kind of self-discovery, not just group discovery. I think we confuse the two.
Go through a nominal activity, and that nominal activity is where you are, nominal meaning working alone.
Yeah.
And somebody come up with all the ideas for the use of an iPhone that's not talking or texting.
Right.
And you go, well, I could use this. I could use it as a coaster. I could use it as a mini computer. I could use it as a flashlight. That's how those things came about, is somebody going, oh, I could use it as this. Then when you get to a group, you have somebody else who came up with a whole different list. And what happens is where groups are best is when they merge ideas and where they evaluate. Because if you get into original thinking in a group, there's competition and that self-regulating begins. And so does the group regulation. So, yeah, so innovation is, you know, brainstorming. I hate to say it, but traditional brainstorming doesn't work.
Yeah, no, I actually, funny, nobody expects me to say it, but I actually 100% agree with you. And in fact, it's, you know, I try to get people to realize it, and I'd love to get your perspective on this. I think actually creativity is something we all have. Some of us just spend more time using and practicing and being in that gym of innovation every day. And it's really not about that 3 p.m. brainstorm with the scented markers and the easel pad, right, and the horrible, you know, if you were an animal in the jungle, what animal would you be, question that the moderator asks. It's just horrible. But innovation or creativity is really can be something that you do on a regular basis.
I think most people do it every day. I tell people all the time, when you look at the analytical thinker or the structured thinker or the social thinker or the conceptual thinker, we all have a tendency to think that the conceptual person is the creative person.
Right.
They are, in a way that is very random. The social person is very creative in terms of how they put people together and how they think about people. The structured person is very creative in terms of how they look at processes.
Right.
They'll create a whole brand new process, and that's creating, which is creativity. And the analytical person is able to kind of create a whole new world by thinking strategically that this is what's happening now. It will add up to this in 5 years. This is what I think we should do in order to answer to that. That's all creativity. We have a tendency to think that creativity is art, that it's a brand new product, that it's, you know, anytime that we create something that is new, so I guess that is a brand new product, but anytime we do that, no matter which domain, it is creativity.
Right.
So I bristle when I meet people who are very structured and like processes and spreadsheets, and they say I'm not creative.
Oh, it drives me crazy.
Have you ever created a system? They're like, I have. I'm like, that's creativity.
Right. Yeah. Oh, it drives me absolutely. It's one of the main things I talk about in my keynotes and why we created that assessment, the innovation quotient thing, because we're tired of people saying, well, I'm not the creative one. It's, you know, Susie down the hall with her blue hair and her apple, and she works in a cafe, and like, cause that's the creative person. Right. So let's kind of dig in. I want to dig in a little bit further. These are all my notes. I have so many questions to ask you. You know, one of the charts that really struck me was that high arousal, low arousal, and then the adrenaline. And, I can't explain it much more than that without obviously kind of showing people my horrible drawings and all that. But You know, I was curious in that. So high arousal was about presentations and staying awake, competing, playing in sports, and low was about kind of, you know, analyzing, meditation, thinking. I just, from broad strokes, would love to understand how those two states and when you're in them impact your ability to perform and your ability to be successful. Because one of the things that I just to preface it really quickly, one of the things I appreciate about your book, and I want to make sure is kind of an overlay to all of this, is you talk about all of this stuff, while interesting from a, you know, academic perspective, also impacts your ability to be successful in life and work. And that's the part that I think we really want to understand as not just entrepreneurs and as leaders in organizations, but also just as human. So will you talk a little bit about that arousal and the adrenaline and kind of how all that plays together into success or what could be successful?
Sure. So when I wrote Activate Your Brain, I really thought about, you know, how, what are the parts of pieces that we can activate and that we can actually have some say in, you know, and when I say some say, there's no magic. You don't pressure temple and all of a sudden, you know, something that is in your temporal lobe, you know, activates. You're not going to press your medial orbital frontal cortex and get the go button and the no button.
Wouldn't that be like, it's the left tooth. That does it every time.
But what does happen is our response to, again, if you look at neurochemistry as a cascade, and I'm not going to give you a neurochemical lesson, but arousal is just kind of a heightened state of alertness. And so when you're in high arousal, you're going to have higher noradrenaline or norepinephrine, which is like adrenal-based, and it makes you more engaged, more alert, you're paying attention. So when you're doing a presentation, you should be in high arousal. When you're in a competition, you should be in high arousal. When you're in an interview, you should be in high arousal, right? But not so high that it actually creates anxiety. And that's where people fall off the wagon, when the cortisol, which is your hormone that is a stressor hormone, when that mixes with high arousal, all of your behavior narrows, and all you can do is what you've always done.
So is that the example you give in the book about, like, when you're on stage and you forget your lines, even though you know what you want to say, you just, it goes blank? Is that too high?
Yeah, so exactly right. Okay. So if you're giving a presentation, a business presentation in front of executives, you feel your arousal go way off the chart, and all of a sudden your mouth gets dry and you can't, and that's going to happen. But when it gets past that and you can't remember,
you can't pull it back.
What happens is that it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you know, you really have the information locked in there, but you trying to memorize it is, first off, a faulty network. You shouldn't try to memorize anything. You should just go for big chunks.
We'll need to dig into that in a second.
But if you want to access what you already know, you should be on high arousal, but not so high that your cortisol literally prevents the prefrontal cortex, the part that thinks, from having any access to your memories. Because all you can do is try to remember the thing you tried to remember, and you can't.
Right, and you can't.
And so you go into a brain freeze. Low arousal is, you know, for meditation, for hanging out, for reading a book, for watching TV, and it's a lovely space, and it's just not going to be, you know, something that you're going to be, you know, it doesn't require a lot of excitement. Low arousal actually is kind of medium, low to medium arousal is where a lot of creativity happens. High arousal with high cortisol, you don't get creativity. Again, you get the old neural pathways that you've always used. Think about it like this. It's a survival mode, and the survival mode says fight or flight. Adrenaline goes up, cortisol goes up, and it says run from the bear. It doesn't want you to stop and negotiate with the bear and think about, hey, bear, should we have a chat about whether you want to kill me and eat me or not? It literally puts you into survival mode so that you access only the neural pathways that will allow you to survive that moment. Unfortunately, when you're in an intellectual endeavor like presenting, unfortunately, it clops off access for the most part to the prefrontal cortex, the part that thinks. So you go on a brain freeze because you're in fight or flight, and it's fight, flight, or freeze. It's the three F's. It's all three. Mm. You're in the freeze now. You're like, right? So the arousal pieces are, you know, where we're most concerned is high arousal. because what we want to do is make sure that we're in high arousal but not high, high stress, right? And they're two separate things. I want to be excited, but I don't want to have, I want to look at this presentation and think, I'm excited for this. I think they're going to love this. I think they're going to get new information. I think they're going to, my boss is going to see that I've done a good job. That's high arousal. Stress is, oh my gosh, what if I screwed up? What if they don't like it? What if I get fired for saying the wrong words, right? That now you've combined the two.
Right.
And the stressor hormone's going to take over.
So how do I, if I'm in that moment and I feel myself going up to the place where I don't want to be, how do I get back down?
It's, you know, the easiest thing, and this is going to sound kind of ridiculous, but it's been well researched, is that literally three deep breaths reset the back down into a relaxation response. Now, if you're in front of an audience, you're going.
So that's why they were looking at me funny.
You know. But what I tell people to do is before you go into the presentation, get relaxed so that you're not already starting out at a high level.
Right.
So you want to kind of begin that way. Exercise brings down the stress response. If you're in the middle of a stress response, you want to take a moment. You want to take at least one deep breath. Just, and you don't have to. I'm always thinking of the audience because I speak a lot.
Yeah.
But there are lots of places, you know, that we get into really high stress response. Somebody's yelling at you. Right? Somebody's screaming at you and you want to respond right away.
Yeah.
Well, you're not getting on that airplane that you want to get on,
right?
And that ticket agent's not having it.
Were you with me at the airport yesterday?
And you want to lambast her or him to let them know how important you are.
Right.
You're in high arousal and high stress. And research has shown pretty much that the first thing that you do or say in that response is likely going to be something that is not useful for you.
Mm.
So you want to, it takes about 6 seconds to dissipate the intensity of both the cortisol and the adrenaline coming up.
Oh.
So literally what your mother said was right, is just bite your tongue for a few seconds and you're standing there just.
Yeah.
And you, one of the things you can do is reframe. Okay, so what you're saying is there is no way for me to get on this flight. You're bringing it down, right? You want to take the time to maybe reframe. Some of it is waiting. Some of it's walking away. These are all emotional intelligence things, but they're connected to the stress response.
So I want to – this is very funny. The airport thing is totally me, by the way. I have a problem at the airport. I can maintain composure until I get to the airport, and then I'm triggered completely. And I was, you know, kind of, I was smiling as I was reading your book, because at the end of the chapters, you know, some of the to-dos was wait 10 seconds. And, you know, I've gotten to the habit of, I don't know if this helps, so tell me what you think, but when someone, particularly when someone's asking me to do something, and I have this emotional thought in my brain of, oh my God, you're sucking me dry of all my info, but you're not paying me, or oh my God, right? That's kind of the emotional baggage that's going on in my head. What I learned to say before I answer is tell me more before I respond. Because if I respond right away, I get mad later at what my response was.
That's a perfect example of that. And
yeah.
Tell me more is a great way to give yourself some time to come down.
Yeah, because I need
part of emotional management is being aware that you are losing it. And
yeah.
If we have a lot of unaware people who lose it and just like, well, I was supposed to lose it in that situation. And I always ask, well, so how did that work out for
right.
you?
Right. Would that benefit you at all?
Yeah. What was the end result of that? Did you wreck a relationship? Did you wreck trust? Did you get what you wanted and now you badgered somebody into it? You know, what was the end result of it? Likely 98% guess is it didn't work.
Yeah.
It rarely works. You might get on the airplane, but you got a little red flag next to your name now.
Right. Well, I'm pretty sure I got that flag. So, and you're saying it works when you're externally, internally triggered. Like, this is what happened the last couple of weeks. So externally triggered was someone asking me to, you know, go out to lunch with them so they could suck me dry of all my knowledge, you know, without kind of considering that, without really being considerate of that's an hour of my time, you know. And with nothing in return, which sounds horrible, but there's nothing worse than can I pick your brain in a lot of ways. So that's the external trigger for me of someone saying something to me. And then the internal being, you know, I had a phone call with a client and I performed horribly. And the minute I hung up the phone, I knew it. Like my brain just went haywire of all the things I wish I had said. I was not on my game. And but you're saying in both of those situations, right, take that. I think in the book you talk about 10 seconds, pause a lot. So take that pause and get and realize what you're doing and get back to a better place.
Yeah. Yeah. So I somebody asked me, my business partner, she asked me because she'll come and see me speak a lot.
Yeah.
And she asked me how I like to get feedback. And I have very strong parameters around it because I know how I respond to it. Mm. I like feedback. I don't want it immediately after I'm done. I can't process it.
Yeah.
I'm just coming down in my own feedback loop, in my
yes.
own
head. So
unless
true.
I ask for it. If I ask, if, how did this piece go, then I'm open for it. But otherwise, I'm not open to it within 24, 48 hours. But it needs also to be, so it needs to be close to the time that I did the speech or the
right.
act.
So it's still top of mind.
It not just top of mind, but that it has to be timely. It's got to be very timely, and the feedback has to be specific. It can't be, you could do better than that. It's got to be specific. Mm. So timely, specific, and frequent is the best way to you know, kind of get that type of feedback. When we are out there in the world and we're met with all kinds of stressors, you know, we need to start to understand what kind of compassion do we need to give ourselves? What kind of parameters do we need to give ourselves that says, I'm not going to go to lunch this time. Or if I do go to lunch, here's the homework you have to do beforehand.
Right.
You've got to email and send to me your three top questions. Or I'll spend time with you, but not in at lunch, but on the phone.
Right.
So where you stop resenting that person for
right.
your decisions.
And it's not their fault, right? They're just trying
right.
to get out in the world and make connections. It's my baggage that's the problem.
Right. We all would love to pick the brain of the person we want to pick the brain
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely, yeah.
We all want to do that. But, you know, what our if we say yes, where we kind of begin to trigger a lot of these neurochemical kind of stressors.
Yeah.
Is when we resent the fact that we said yes, and then they're not behaving the way that we would expect them to behave.
But that's not their fault, right? That's ours for saying yes.
It's a tough loop.
Yeah, it is a loop. I feel like I'm going to be a better person coming out of this interview with you because I will manage myself better. I want to, people around you, my husband will thank you, my team will thank you. I don't know what happened on that podcast interview, but tomorrow's much nicer. I want to delve into confidence because you actually spend a lot of time, you have a whole chapter really dedicated to confidence. And in particular, because I think confidence is one of those things you hear a lot. It's like authenticity. I feel like there's words that get thrown out all the time, you know, step into your power and be confident and, you know, be authentic and be comfortable with yourself. But nobody really explains why that matters or how it impacts you. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's my soapbox, but it's this kind of big word that gets thrown around a lot. But you said something that was really interesting to me, which was that confidence in a lot of ways is a willingness to jump into something even if you don't have 100% guarantee. So the confidence isn't the guarantee it'll work. It's the fact that you're confident enough to jump in and try.
Yeah.
So will you talk a little bit about confidence? Because to me, that is, you know, I see a lot of new inventions and behind every new invention is an innovator. And if, you know, people always ask me what's the key to the invention success. And sometimes it's the invention, but more often than not, it's the inventor and their confidence and their persistence, regardless of the invention. So will you talk, just expound about confidence? Because
sure.
it's so important.
Yeah, it's a big topic, and you're right. It does get bantered around, and it's sometimes thrown around in very sophomoric ways in terms of saying to somebody, oh, just go be confident. It doesn't work that way, you know. And no, a couple of rules about confidence. Number one, confidence isn't something that you have or keep at all times. It's you can have a general underlying confidence about you, but you might get into a situation where you don't feel confident.
Yeah.
You know, when we look at confident is just another word for sure.
Oh.
If I feel sure.
When you put it that way, it doesn't seem so scary.
Yeah, it doesn't feel so scary. And it's a surety. Hmm. People who have less confidence need more guarantees on the other side. You know, they need to, I don't want to go out there and try that because I don't want to look bad. Somebody who has a baseline confidence, who feels like they're not sure on the other end, but they're sure of themselves. And they say, I'm sure enough about myself that if I look bad trying this, I don't really care.
So it's the ability to separate those two.
It is. It's kind of, in the book, I talk about the fact of bowling. I think bowling is one of the greatest sports of all time because we all love to do it and nobody cares how bad they look when they do it, right? We don't care how badly.
That is hysterical.
Right? We just don't care how bad we look, but we love to do it.
Yeah.
That is kind of an example of a confident person is that, sure, I'll go bowling. I don't care if I end up with, you know, getting 20 pins down in the entire game. It's still fun. They're willing to try. And because they're willing to try more often. And it's this self-perpetuating loop that happens. And what ends up happening is the more that you are willing, the more willing you will be. Right. And so that is that feedback loop that starts to happen. So when I look at someone who is timid about life and is unsure, which means oftentimes they're unsure of their response to being judged, to looking bad, to all of the things going on in their head about something. One of the best things they could do is the thing they want to do the least, and that is just to try and release the idea of looking good. Go out and play tennis. Maybe you miss 10 out of 11 balls.
Who cares?
But many people do. And the problem with confidence is if you find yourself caring all the time about just looking perfect in all situations, it's a problem. And perfectionism has actually been assigned an emotional mental, it's in the DSM as a syndrome, because it's something you can never win at, and it creates anxiety, and that anxiety stops people from doing things. So when I look at confidence, and confidence is huge, you know, there's self-efficacy. Do you believe you can?
Right.
There's self-potentiation. Do you believe you have the potential to get better? There is self-esteem. Do you like yourself? There's self-regard. Do you like both the parts that are good and bad? You know, and all of them can have, you know, it's not like self-esteem is a great, you know, psychopaths have high self-esteem. They think they're God, right?
Yeah.
They think they're God. So it's never any one part that makes confidence. It's all the bits and pieces. But at the baseline, confident people, they look at their good, they look at their bad, and they say, I like my good. I like my good well enough that the things that I don't like about me, the good things take care of. I don't spend my time focused on my body image, my hair image, my whatever it is that they think they're lacking. I don't spend either time on completely overcompensating for or masking around it constantly. And so you see a lot of inconfident people spending a lot of time making sure you don't see the thing that they don't want you to see.
Right.
And you get a lot of bravado that way. You get a lot of strange behavior that you know, when you kind of come upon the thing that they don't want you to see, don't get near that. So confidence is a cool and sexy thing, and the cool and sexy thing about it is that we all look and love that person who says, I'll go out and I'll try it. Sure, I'll get in that stupid conga line and go up on the stage. Whatever.
Right. Yes, we do love that person. But I love the way you broke it down, that it's not just like take a deep breath and be confident. It really is about kind of getting out there, being confident enough to try something and not having the worry of what people are going to think as the reason to do or not do something.
Right.
And I think when you're trying to be innovative, and I see this in large organizations in particular, and with people with ideas too, is they don't go for something because they're afraid of what others might think. And, you know, and I think this plays into what you're saying. Oftentimes, kind of my advice is take little baby steps towards it. It's not necessarily an all or none. The idea doesn't have to be perfect before you get out into the world. In fact, I'd rather it be with duct tape and a piece of paper first so that you can get some real world feedback on it, A, but also B, so you can build up that confidence of like one step at a time of getting it out there, because it's not easy, but it is worth it. And if you fail, I mean, here's what I find so ironic about failure or worrying about failure is people are so worried about being judged for failure or being a failure or failing at something. But more often than not, the people that I meet are proud of the person for trying because they would have never done it themselves. So I think we sometimes worry about the stuff that doesn't actually, it's not actually how other people respond.
And you know, living your whole life worried about how other people will respond to what you just did is a difficult way to live. Now, I'm on the other end of the spectrum. I find completely disingenuous people who say, this is who I am, just deal with it. Or I, you know, I don't care.
They're masking. That's what you were saying earlier. They're masking something else.
And people who say, I don't care about what other people think. I think we all do to some degree. I think to live in society, we have to care about if we've hurt your feelings or if the way that we put that was too hard or too soft. Or we have to pay attention to that. But confidence is more the focus on, I'm going to try something, and then I want you to put up your judgment card. And that's what we're focused on, is that judgment card. Did I get a 10?
Yeah.
And people with high confidence aren't looking for the card. They just get out there. They're looking for the fun, the thrill of going,
the game.
I'll try that. And, you know, the other piece to it is this, is that confidence requires courage. And courage is not courage without fear. A little bit of scariness. It's scary. I think I quote David White, the poet, in the book, who said, you know, courage is feeling like you're stepping out onto a surface that can't hold you. And you do it anyway.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you do it anyway. And there's nothing wrong with going to a confidant or somebody else and saying, I'm not completely confident about this. Could you give me feedback? And so it's not about going it alone. And this whole idea of you're going to... your package is confident or it's not. No, people tell me all the time, do that or don't do that. I'm like, cool. That makes me more confident because now I have not just my perspective, because my perspective is I'm going to hurt myself if I do this. And you're telling me, no. So every once in a while, we need that extra dose from someone who will give us a little shot in the bottom and say, yes, you should go.
I think what you just said about not going out alone is incredibly important. And we have this, I think, myth in our heads that these people who go out and do amazing things are these lone innovators, mavericks, whatever, in their garage by themselves. But that's not actually how any of it works. And in fact, if you look at some of the, you know, most successful people in the world, I would argue that probably all of them have a team of some kind around them to bounce stuff off of, to test things out, to help them where they're not, you know, where they don't, you can't be good at everything, right? So somebody has to help you somewhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, confident people, they know what they're good at. They know what they're not.
Yeah.
And the things that they're not, if they're game, they're game. They're game at more things. They're willing to try more things than people who are not confident.
Right.
And, you know, over time, what ends up happening is you confident people hit on a lot more things because they sample a lot more of the world. They hit on a lot more interesting things that they end up doing. So confident people feed their confidence by trying something and seeing that it never hurt them.
Right, right. And in fact, if they didn't get it or didn't work, it wasn't the end of the world. And
it's
if they
not,
got
you
it,
move,
great.
You move on to something else. And,
right.
And so a lack of confidence is going to be crushing every time that you don't get that 10, that
now,
card with the
right.
10 on it.
Now I understand why you have a whole chapter, because it is so important to success. I love football. I have my stats wrong. But I will say that, you know, I think it was Brett Favre at one point held the record for most completed passes and most interceptions. So, and maybe I got that wrong, but I like to think it's right because I like Brett Favre. But
not as well as Peyton Manning.
Wow. Yesterday was an epic day for everybody in Colorado.
That's exactly.
But my only point being that, right, it's, you know, there's so many failures underneath all those successes or what we would consider failures, but frankly, it's just a point in time.
It's just a point in time.
Yeah.
It's a way for your brain to learn what not to do.
All right. So if you're out there listening and watching, I think go get a dose of confidence in this much more real world way, which thank you, because it's one of those words that I find very frustrating.
If I was going to coach people on this concept without it just to say, you know, go buy some confidence, I would put a sign on my computer or my mirror on the wall that just says, be willing. Be willing. Just be willing.
Great
and there
advice.
Are going to be the times when you're not, and I get that, and it's not about 100%, but be more willing. You know, be more willing to try things, and the better you get at that, the less scary the world seems.
Scott, that is a great piece of advice to end on. So I've got two final questions for you, although I would love to talk to you for 2 more hours, but at some point we have to stop talking.
Yeah.
So this last question is very... the What am I trying to say? I lost my train of thought. Am I having a cortisol moment? Or did I just lose my train of thought? where can people find you? How can they connect with you? How can they buy your book?
So they can find me at www.completeintelligence.com. So Complete Intelligence is my company, .com. And they can hook up with me at Scott, with two T's, at CompleteIntelligence.com. My book is Activate Your Brain, and you can find it Barnes & Noble, Amazon. Those are the easiest places to find it. Goodreads, any of those, any of your internet booksellers have it.
Awesome. Both Kindle. And yeah. we didn't say in the beginning, but just give us a brief overview of what you and your organization do and who you do it for.
Yeah. So I work in generally in large corporations. I've worked with some small ones as well, but work with executives who are in high pressure jobs to help them perform at better and more effective levels. We do it all through the lens of the brain, and the topics that we cover through the lens of the brain and performance are emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and influence. And those all are kind of brain-based that have what they all have in common is that they have an external piece that everybody can see. I can see the way you think. I can see the way you influence. I can see the way that you interact. They're all very connected. So that's what
we'll have to do another call to talk specifically about emotional intelligence, because I think that's a fascinating soft, hard skill kind of topic. So the last question for you is, what is one thing people would be super surprised to learn about you, personal or professional? Doesn't matter.
They would be super surprised if they met me and saw me out in the world, because I am very public. I do a lot of public speaking and I love people. But what they would be surprised is how much I love my downtime. Mm. I love to read. I love a lot of solitary time. I like to be around people, but I don't always like to interact with them. So I like, if I'm in a hotel, I like to read at the bar. But I don't necessarily want to go there to get into a big conversation.
People.
And I love people, but I do so much of it that I actually really love. So that's always surprising to people who know me well.
You know, it's so funny, Scott. So I got Beats headphones, partially because they're good headphones, but partially to wear on airplanes so people wouldn't talk to me. And it's not, again, same thing. It's not that I don't love people. I love them, but I get very exhausted after speaking. And I need to, so I totally get that. So if I see you in a bar reading a book, I won't be like, hey, 10 questions.
Hey, babe.
I got some stuff to talk about. Oh my gosh. Scott, that was so great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.